Well, this evening we're fortunate to have Helen Thomas and Alexis Simendinger as our guests. Helen has covered Washington since 1943. She came to Washington, right? Or was it 42?
43.
And has covered the White House since the Kennedy administration, although she covered First Ladies Bess Truman and Mamie Eisenhower as well. Mm-hmm. And Alexis grew up in Washington and has covered the White House for National Journal since the Clinton administration, and before that covered the George H.W. Bush administration and the earlier part of Clinton for the Bureau of National Affairs. So we have a we've been sitting here discussing various things about the White House, and I stopped Helen from answering a question I gave her, which was looking at the president. She was talking about Johnson, about covering Johnson, and how personal that coverage was, how things have changed since then. But tell us about Johnson and what it was like to cover him.
Love, hate, relationship. It was a three-ring circus. LBJ was so paranoid, and yet he wanted close relations with the press.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted to be on the front page every day, very positively. Uh-huh. He went through five press secretaries because he couldn't stand anyone speaking for him. But he was, domestically, I think he was a great president. The Great Society was great. In 2 years, on the tailwind of the Kennedy assassination, he got through Civil Rights Act, voting rights for blacks for the first time in the South, federal aid to education at all levels, from Head Start through college, public housing, environmental laws, child maternal health, you name mm-hmm. it, mm-hmm. to put that foundation beyond which people in this country will starve, lack for education or medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, but he also gave us a lot of access. And when he was agonizing over the Vietnam War, and he was trying to decide what to do, and yet he didn't want to cave at all, and he should have declared a victory and left, as Senator Aiken told him, everybody would have been happy. But he would call us for walks around the South Lawn in days when we wore the high heels and uh-huh. pointed toes, and we were all dying. And we would call these marches the Bataan Death Marches. And we were falling all over each other. And at the end, after pouring out his heart, letting his hair down, we'd go back. He would say, "This is all off the record," and we would groan. But of course, we knew he wanted us to write it on our own, not say the President of the United States. So we'd go back to the press room and compare notes and uh-huh. make it up. Practically.
But
we got the drift of what was going on.
Yeah.
How he felt.
Would he put it on the record at any time?
Yes. I mean, basically, he knew it was going to show up. It was a game with him. But I think he was trying to tell the country how he felt, and he felt very bad that things were going bad, and yet he could not extricate himself from the war.
Mm-hmm. Since that time, wow, what presidents can you think of that that have given reporters a lot of access?
Well, he was the most.
Uh-huh.
I mean, access is everything. You get really a feel for what's going on and the thinking of a president. I certainly had a lot of access when President Carter would walk down the street, Main Street in Plains, Georgia. He was not that accessible otherwise. But I think the others sort of kept a distance.
Mm-hmm.
With Kennedy, it was easy, too, in a way, because you really didn't have 24-hour cable
right.
or
uh-huh.
television and that sort of thing. And we were freer. We would go to Hyannisport with him or Palm Beach and had a lot of walking around. He didn't like it exactly, and mm-hmm. He's always accused of having a great relationship with the press, but he really was trying to duck us all the time.
Uh-huh.
You know, when I was covering the Clinton administration, Helen and I remember having a conversation with you about reporters. Some reporters were very up in arms about efforts to try to do off-the-record access to the president or to the first lady to try to see if there was a way to manage that. And some reporters were saying they didn't want to participate in that. They wanted to reserve the right to say no. They didn't want to do that. And I remember you saying that you would never turn down an opportunity to do that because it's all about the complete picture, trying to get access in whatever way you can. Do you still think
I still feel that way because they can lay down the rules, but the more they tell you, the more you know, and some way, somehow, you'll work it out. Mm-hmm. I remember when, after Johnson had renounced running for re-election, and he gave a reception for all the diplomats, and in those days, we used to cover these receptions, and we had always been warned by Liz Carpenter, Mrs. Johnson's press secretary, to try to be dainty, and carry little notebooks and so forth, and be, you know, fade into the woodwork. Uh-huh. Well, after, you know, Johnson couldn't stand to be alone, and pretty soon reporters became people. And after the reception, he gathered up a group of newspaper women, took them to the family quarters, and started regaling us with all. He was in a very nostalgic mood and telling us all the things his observations of his presidency and so forth. And pretty soon, Lady Bird Johnson came in a robe and said, "Now, Lyndon, trying to break it up." And so finally he got the message. And at the end of the session, he gave us each a little charm bracelet. And I had been scribbling on this little notebook and grabbing matchbooks and writing on napkins and everything else. And he said, "Now you know. It's all off the record." Well, of course, it wasn't to us. Later on, we used little bits and pieces.
Uh-huh. How many women were there that
came
into that
session? There were about six or seven in that group.
And that's really changed in the time that you've covered the White House.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Tremendous.
And Helen is always so generous to young female reporters. Not the males. Not that you're not kind to them, too, but you're really nice to the women.
Well, yeah. I want them all to go into the greatest profession in the world.
You do. You're very kind.
No, it's true.
One of the points that you've always talked about is that the role of reporters in a democratic society, what role news organizations can have. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. I think that we are indispensable in a democracy, that you cannot have a democracy without an informed people. And I think that we perform a public service from that aspect. Mm-hmm. I think that we are not well paid. We work long hours. News never breaks on your time. Uh-huh. But as long as people are on this planet, there will be news. And journalism is an education every day. It's a two-way street. But I think that without reporters and without presidential news conference is the only forum in our society where a president can be questioned. And he should be questioned to be held accountable. And when he refuses to hold them, you know that there's a real blackout on the news. He could be a king. He could be a dictator if he's not questioned, because the only other possibility would be for Congress to subpoena him, and they're not going to do that unless it's absolutely dire. Mm-hmm. So we're great. And needed.
But not always loved.
I'm not president. Certainly not always loved. That's the most. I mean, if you want to be loved, don't go into journalism, please, because you will be disappointed. People resent you. You are the messenger who brings the bad news.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of benefits do you think press conferences have for reporters and also for the government? What kind of benefits there are for a presidential press conference?
Well, you know what the president's thinking. Mm-hmm. You get it from the horse's mouth. Nothing can replace the president himself speaking for himself. Uh-huh. I mean, a spokesman, sure, will try to convey what's in his mind and cover it up a bit, mm-hmm. but hearing it from the president is the most important thing, whatever it is, and he should be accountable. He should hold news conferences once a week, really.
Mm-hmm. And inside the White House, there's so often this discussion, no matter what administration or what party it is, that it has a disciplining effect on the inside of the government. In other words, for the president to stand there for 45 minutes and take a variety of questions he does not know in advance, he has to work with his staff to get prepped, right? He goes to school a little bit beforehand. Bill Clinton used to do it for hours, do a lot of murder board kind of prep to look natural and informed.
Right.
And that is a kind of a galvanizing effect inside the administration. The president gets to know what his cabinet departments are doing. Okay. What is our position on this legislation? What's the latest on something? And he's forced to kind of contain a lot of information at one point.
Mm-hmm. Truman said that he really got the feedback from what the people were thinking from the news conferences.
Uh-huh.
And Reagan used to go to in a tank in a weekend as though he were preparing for a PhD before a news conference. Uh-huh. But he held them, and he held prime time, and he wasn't afraid to face us.
Yeah, that's true. He would take 2 days out on his calendar to prepare for news conferences. So it's true that around the government, they recognize, the cabinet secretaries recognize, as Alexa said, that they have to tell the president what's going on.
That's right.
That because they know he could end up being embarrassed, and so he ends up they find out a lot more than they would otherwise.
Well, this president doesn't seem to know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
The president is doing more news conferences in the second term than he was eager to do in the first term, and you've watched that. You know, like me, we watch that migration towards more news conferences. Why do you think he's doing more?
Is he?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, he has. And then actually, when you compare
him. When was the last one he held?
About
a month ago?
It was at the end of the year.
Yeah, well, I mean, really, you call that a lot?
Well, no, I mean, numerically speaking.
Numerically.
No, he's still in the basement on this, Helen. Don't get me wrong. But we're working from zero upward. Is what I'm talking about
FDR, here. Franklin D. Roosevelt held them twice a week.
But they were.
Of course, it wasn't quoted directly.
Yeah, that's right. They were off the record, and Truman would change things around if he saw he was in hot water. Then,
but at least he held them.
Yeah.
Well, we should ask Dr. Kumar, the woman, the stat lady. The president calls you the stat lady, so you should tell us about his stats. It's like ESPN. You're like the ESPN of news.
Well, his stats. He is holding. Compared to his first term, his solo press conferences, is he holding more?
He became more confident. You're right.
You think?
Right. And he's held more in terms of other presidents as well. He's held more than Clinton did in his second term.
Is that right?
At this point,
Because of Monica Lewinsky.
Well,
that
did subdue
him
a bit. That's a different topic of discussion.
Yeah, that was a bleak time as far as press conferences.
Drought. We were in a major drought.
I must say, he did hold them despite all. Yeah. I couldn't understand how he could stand there.
Yeah.
Pilloried, really.
Uh-huh.
When are you going to resign? That kind of question, for starters.
Well, one of the things that the president did in his first term was he held those short question and answer sessions. And they were done on a fairly regular basis. But in the second term, one of the consequences of the solo press conferences going up is that the short Q&As have gone down. But they, too, are a venue where the president's put on the spot. And
you know that.
You mean for the photo?
Going in for a photo op.
Yeah.
Right.
But he says, I'll take one question. I mean, he won't allow follow-ups, which demand them, practically. So he gets away with murder.
Also, this president likes to do something that, in my experience, much briefer than Helen's, is a little unusual in that he likes everything to be tidy and orderly. So he's calling on the reporter in advance. In other words, in a short Q&A, he knows which wires are going to be there. Yeah. And he's calling on them by name. And he knows who he's going to call on. So he doesn't want to see anybody shouting questions or raising a hand.
He's got a little list.
He's got
but
a list at a news conference.
Protective, it's not just because he's trying to be orderly.
Right.
He doesn't want to be caught in left field.
Right. But I don't want people to think he knows what you're going to ask. He just knows who he's going to call on.
I think he knows because they follow the briefings, and he's prepped beforehand by the press secretary who said they've been asking every day about Katrina or whatever.
Right, but I'm just saying he doesn't know the exact frame of a question. It's not like it's given to him in advance. It's not
true.
Like Putin, right?
No,
it's not
quite.
We're not there.
Almost.
Well, You had been asking Scott about the link between Saddam and Al Qaeda, and you were pointing out that there was no link. And one of those days that you, because you've raised that on more than one occasion.
Because the president said there was no link, but every speech he's made since 9/11, he has mentioned the link.
Well,
give me a break.
That question came to him after you had been asking it in the briefing, and then one of the wire service reporters in a Q&A, asked it in the cabinet room, and he said, no, there wasn't a link.
That's right.
And so even those opportunities where you get to ask one question, one question can be
important. It helped a lot, that's true, but a lot of those questions demand a follow-up. Mm-hmm. And he's been very sparse on that. You can interject and just push ahead, but.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there was a time period that was ideal, a golden age, in terms of the kinds of information that reporters could get from the White House?
I wouldn't call it a golden age, but I think that Kennedy's news conferences were great. Mm-hmm. They had warmth, they had wit. You couldn't really catch him off guard. That doesn't mean he was always telling the truth, but at the same time, you definitely had a feeling, and the country loved them.
Uh-huh.
This was their first introduction to a televised news conference.
Yeah.
And really, I think they became hooked on it. Kennedy he showed a lot of charm.
Uh-huh. But do you think that the kind of information that we got about how government was running, do you think that we have more information at that time period than we do today about how government is working?
I do, and how the White House works? The most secretive administration I've ever covered.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think Cheney's refusal to announce the shooting.
That he shot somebody in the face?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't, they are so secretive about everything, it came naturally.
Uh-huh.
I think one of the things that I feel as a reporter is that we have a lot more information in some ways, but so much less understanding of what the president is doing, what the administration is actually executing, what the process is of the decision making. You know, there's a lot of static information thrown out there, either
but not from the White House. You're getting it on internet, you're getting it in other places.
Or even from the White House in terms of just flooding the zone with information, you know,
I call
their
it propaganda.
Version, their fact
Scott
sheets.
McClellan's talking to the cameras. I'm talking to the American people. You can ask him a question, and he will give you the same answer that he's given to everybody else, no matter what the question is. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is this?
But that's a form of information without any understanding. And Helen's making the case about follow-up questions to build an understanding. And that's what I think, that's why I'm relating to what you're saying so sympathetically, because that's what I find, you know, that you're trying to build an understanding of the policy, the politics of something, the struggles, the challenges, you know, what it is they're doing, why it is they're doing it.
Right.
And that's what's really difficult to do.
And do you think in part that's because they don't bring out people to talk about policy?
That's true.
Clinton administration, there were a lot of people who would come out in the press room and economic advisors. Gene Sperling was there all the time, and people generally were pretty available in talking about the policy and then also talking about why they made decisions as they did. And, of course, the president himself enjoyed talking about
policy.
Unless
they're preparing for a trip, then they'll bring the national security advisor or whatever. But, I mean, President Bush, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, made a speech, always to a sanitized audience, I must say, either veterans or military or Chamber of Commerce. He said, we're not in this war because of oil, Israel, or us misleading the people. Nobody has asked him why we're in Iraq to this moment. I mean, that was a natural in a way.
You mean a member of the public? Because I hear you asking this all the time, Helen.
Well, okay, a member of the
public. But just like
And I never get the answer.
And you never get the answer.
No. It's unbelievable. I don't know how we can be in a war for 3 years and it's never defined except that if we don't go there, they'll all come here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is this?
Well, you know, Martha, you were talking about trying to build that understanding with a variety of sources from within the administration. In the Clinton years, they used that to build credibility. Mm-hmm. Here's our homework. Here are the facts. Here are the footnotes that go with this. And they used experts from inside the administration, and not just political appointees. I was looking through an old transcript for a story that I was working on this week, and I came across a transcript in which they were putting into the White House briefing room what's called a PAD, meaning a career official in the Office of Management and Budget, to describe a particular technique that they were using in terms of budgeting. Mm-hmm. Put that guy in front of the microphone to describe something they were doing. This was a person who had a lot of credibility because he was career and he had served a lot of administrations. The Clintons just were very trusting about that was going to work out for them, that they had a variety of experts who could talk to the media, and that would all be used by name on the record, sometimes on background. But this administration has continually expressed this worry, mm-hmm. that officials might make news before the president wants to, or that mm-hmm. the only spokesperson for the administration is the president of the United States. It's always about him, they say, and not mm-hmm. about anybody else inside the administration.
Would you say that White Houses reflect, because we've talked about this a lot, White Houses reflect the president, they don't compliment him, in that the weaknesses he has are going to be the weaknesses of the staff, and his strengths are going to be their strengths. And his view is that he should announce policy. He doesn't like to talk about how things are done, and so he doesn't like anybody else doing it either. But the problem from that becomes is that people don't know how he reached the decisions he did. And that has caused him a great deal of trouble.
I know. I was talking to an aide to Vice President Cheney about the vice president's communications theories and desires, and she said, "Oh, Alexis, you know, he's a stater, not a debater," meaning he doesn't care about describing what they do or how they do it or why they do it or why it's important. He likes to just state, and President Bush is very much like that too.
They don't want you to know.
Well, they want you to know the
they
end.
They don't want you to know. Yeah. It's a secrecy pattern. Everything's a secret. I mean, they are apoplectic if you find out anything. That's why they're going after leaks. I love leaks. I love whistleblowers. Whistleblowers are the greatest heroes, in my opinion. They're finally telling us what's going on.
Uh-huh. All presidents hate leaks, though. You've written in your book about how LBJ hated leaks and would change
decisions. Yeah, but I'm talking about this one, too.
And I know covering H.W. Bush, he hated leaks.
Well, mm-hmm. I have a saying. They all promise. All presidential candidates promise on the campaign trail to have an open administration. Yeah. The information belongs to the public, right? As soon as they get into the White House, the Iron Curtain comes down, and information we know belongs in the public domain, most of it should, becomes their private preserve. Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Because they suddenly think they're president, and they think presidents should have everything controlled. This one, they're taking power like mm-hmm. he can wiretap you, he can anything. The president has omnipotent power now, and the American mm-hmm. people should be very angry.
Mm-hmm. I think part
of it
is
I don't want to be wiretapped. Oh, no, I use a megaphone, really. They don't have to wiretap me.
I think they just tap into the briefing and the gaggle.
Go into the White House and say, "Now, why didn't you do this? Can you imagine?"
I think part of that fear of information dissemination or understanding has to do with the transition from campaigning to governing. You know, to campaign, your communication strategy as a candidate is so different than as a mm-hmm. president. And all of a sudden, they get in there and they realize, oh, I'm responsible for this huge, vast executive branch.
They classify the color of the walls when they get in.
Yeah.
I mean, everything, by thousands and thousands of documents. All the banal, inane mm-hmm. things that, mm-hmm. it's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like right now, they're finding out that things that this administration is reclassifying has been in the history books.
Right.
Are you trying to mm-hmm. recall it?
Well, 9/11 uh-huh. created an additional layer of, what I want to say, cover for the administration mm-hmm. initially, this administration. to do so much more about securing information, pulling information off websites and
but it's
away.
A joke.
Well,
I mean,
it's not funny. What do you mean it's a joke?
I mean, it's a joke for what they classify.
Oh, yes,
yeah.
Yes.
But the order under which they're doing it was an order under the Clinton administration that was signed under the Clinton administration. But then after September 11th, then there's been a lot more of it.
Reagan signed a document where he said that all of his papers could be released after 12 years. This Bush president came in and signed up. Oh, there was one caveat that a sitting president could stop the publication.
Yeah,
and
the president
wanted to protect his father, who was part of the Reagan administration very much, and so everything is under lock and key now.
Well, that it comes.
Not, they have let some of it out.
This is a complicated story.
Yeah, that's right.
This is a separate Dr. Kumar class.
Yeah, that executive order is a very complicated kind of thing.
I think the presidency has too much power as they identify it now.
Uh-huh.
Much too much.
And it is absolutely the case, because the vice president and the president have stated this without any embarrassment, that they're trying to strengthen the power of the executive at every opportunity.
Especially Cheney. I mean, they have... think that this usurpation of power belongs to them. It's a divine commitment.
Or that a wartime president needs a strengthened executive.
Why do you think that there are no news organizations that regard the vice president as a beat, someone, and have one person who is dedicated to cover him?
Because you'd be like the Maytag repairman. You'd be sitting in an office, and you wouldn't get close to the guy. I mean, this vice president has pools that go with him and never see him. I mean, this is the edict that he has created about coverage of him, and he can say what happens.
But if you had somebody like, say, the Post or the Times had somebody that was on him all the time, you don't believe that they wouldn't be able to get information? Because you can talk to a lot of people around the government about him.
You're asking a different question, which is what effect would that have on the vice president's behavior? Would he feel as free to take personal trips on taxpayers' money without informing the public where he's going? I don't believe he would feel as free to do that.
Uh-huh.
If he had someone, can I use the word bird dogging? Bird dogging him at all times.
Yeah. Can
I say something?
Surely.
it's a regret of my life that I have not watched vice presidents more. Because in my career, three vice presidents have become president. And all of a sudden, they're a new face, and you have to learn very quickly about them. They should have known.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
Why do news organizations not look at them? Why do they not follow them?
Because I think so much focus is on the president.
Just on the president.
Well,
so
one
heartbeat
away. But
you know, you and I both covered Vice President Gore. So we followed him because
he was saying,
I want to be president.
Because Clinton allowed him to introduce different programs and so he gave him the spotlight and exposure. You don't see that with Cheney.
Well, I just know I wrote a lot about Vice President Gore, and Gore's staff was very open.
He participated.
Yes,
he was
exactly.
active. Cheney wasn't jealous
right.
of him.
When you covered Reagan, did you cover H.W. some?
Yes, quite a bit.
Yeah. Because Reagan gave him a portfolio, too, because he knew that Bush was supposed to be the Reagan third term. Remember, everybody talked about this as being the Reagan third term.
That's right.
Yeah.
So there was a lot more scrutiny. Cheney is just an odd, unusual character, a person of unrivaled power as a vice president, but someone who's made it clear he is not going to serve his country after this.
Yeah, which has meant that he could stay.
Which, you know, gives him this unbelievable strength.
Has he served this country?
Well, you know what I mean. You know what I mean, Helen. This is what she does to the president. What she's doing to her friends.
The president won't call on me. Now you understand why. You're getting the picture.
Do you think
I'm sweating up here next to Helen.
Do you think that the White House being so secretive has meant that that the information about their operations and the operations of the administration did not come out? Is it successful to be secretive, does that mean that the information is not going to come out? Or has it come out and maybe not on their terms? Do you want to take a, Alexis, take a crack at it first.
Well, I would say both. One is that, no, they're not going to be successful at constraining access to that information forever, although they will try. The one thing I don't know is to what extent the new rules of technology and their ideas about archiving information, I mean, we don't know, I don't know personally to what extent they've been successful at keeping certain bits of information from going into the archives. But at some point, we will all see a lot more than we have now. The other thing is that the administration has invited, because of its behavior, scrutiny like the 9/11 Commission or the intelligence, the Silberman-Robb Commission, or even Republican congressional investigations, for instance, of the Katrina handling, because they're, can I say stingy, or Helen would say not at all, because they've been they've been so reluctant to provide information unless they've been compelled to do that, which is really hard to do in a one-party town where you don't, the Democrats don't have the power. The opposition party doesn't have the power to subpoena. But the, I also think that you're pointing out something about second terms. You know, you were saying leaks, there are more leaks in a second term. When the president becomes a lame duck, there's much more criticism and scrutiny, so more information comes out. And then there's a lack of, a cumulative lack of faith in the information that's been disseminated for 5 years. So there is naturally more scrutiny, don't you think?
I think the judge's success by re-election, that we have a president who's been elected twice, that's their criteria. When Ari Fleischer wrote his book, he wrote a book, and the tail end of it says, it's true, I said, there were weapons of mass destruction. He only said it every day for 2 years in the run-up to the book. I said that. And that's, and there weren't any weapons of mass destruction, but we won the election. That's the standard.
If you look at leaks, though, in the first term, there weren't leaks in the White House, but there were leaks all over the administration. I mean, you certainly have had leaks in the State Department. You, had them
and
in
do you
the
wanna,
Defense Department.
You mean unauthorized leaks as opposed to purposeful?
Right, yeah.
You mean
that's true. We should distinguish.
Clarify.
Because, yeah. They certainly do provide information, but I think of that as kind of giving information out, giving stories.
Selective dissemination.
Yeah.
We wouldn't know about torture, secret prisons,
all
NSA? The horrors that have been committed in our name.
Eavesdropping.
Where is our honor?
Right.
The
eavesdropping.
Torture. And wiretapping.
Right.
So in the end, those things have come out, but it's taken a long time.
I think they're horrendous. I think it's so sad that the American people accept this. When you read about the torture, the detail, it is incredible that the American people accept it. This is us.
Well, don't you think that the next White House, whoever, whatever administration it is going to have to recover or reverse or in some way rebound from the Bush communication policies, or do you think they're going to try to emulate it?
I think it's a very good campaign posture for the Democrats, but they don't have the guts to attack the problem. Whoever comes in will probably follow the same pattern of secrecy because they think they're president. Suddenly, this is this power and prestige and so forth. Every wish is a command. It's inherent in the role.
What about, it would depend in some measure, though, on the person of the president. Like Clinton, for example, liked to talk about policy. And so you did have more information coming out. And they believed that as part, I mean, in terms of everything that they were doing, that they assumed that, information was going to come out. So they didn't have, in some ways, the same trouble with leaks, although
well,
with Lewinsky.
Even the handling, I think I would argue, and I don't know what you think, Helen, but I would argue that even Clinton's attitude towards disasters that were you know, they were created themselves or that were foisted upon them or whatever, either handling of scandal was more accessible because their thinking was get out fast, get out front, put it all out there, try to explain what happened, and at least in that small way, control the information in that way.
Yeah.
You know, don't let your enemies get a hold of it at some point. This administration, peculiarly for an administration that you would think would have a learning curve here, again and again is very flat-footed and slow to even realize when things are going to go against them, when it's out of their control. And the examples, Abu Ghraib is a good one, the tsunami disaster, they were so slow realizing.
But Katrina was a huge
Katrina
one.
Was the enormous one.
To tell the president a lot of things until he's the last to know on so many things. And also, he's never, I don't think his, in his lifetime he's had to really handle crisis. No one shouted fire and so forth. I mean, he doesn't seem to react. Anybody else would jump up and do something. And he sits there somehow.
That's part of his management style. I think that's how he's organized the government. You know, this president believes very much in, you know, he talks about this all the time. He tells people, what's the job of a president? And, you know, the president could answer this question any way, a million ways, and he says, it's to be a decision maker, to decide. He says that's the job of a president. So it's like he's parceled out the thinking, you know, the inquisitiveness to other people, and then it's supposed to move up the chain to him, and then he decides. And that's all he thinks is really, I'm exaggerating only slightly, but that's the main thing he needs to do. And actually, I think that it really has hindered him. It's hurt him in terms of his management, his style of being able to get information out of his government so that he could see around the corner. What's going to happen around the corner? Where's trouble going to start? And he's bad at anticipating it.
And one of the problems with it is he has not had people underneath him that he encouraged to get information in unconventional ways, that in order to make his decisions, he needed the best information possible. And it doesn't seem that on a lot of occasions he just has not had that information. And there's been no consequence for his not having it. People haven't been fired.
Right. Until it's been exposed until, and they've been forced
until,
to admit.
Yeah, somebody like.
Or unless they've betrayed him. If he feels that you've been disloyal to him, you're toast.
They're afraid to tell him the truth. Many times, I think they're afraid to approach him. They think he becomes apoplectic and.
What were some of the techniques that other presidents you've covered have used to try to make sure they're not getting all just, yes, Mr. President, you look wonderful today, kinds of commentary?
I think most of them do have yes men around them.
Yeah.
Palace guards always protecting him. Keeper of the gate and so forth. I think that most of them they don't want any back talk. But Kennedy read newspapers. LBJ had 3 teletypes in front of him. He wanted to know everything by the minute. He wanted to know what was going on and so forth. Saturation.
And during the war, wasn't LBJ constantly on the phone to get all kinds of battle statistics,
right? He didn't. I think it's really important that the president read newspapers.
Yeah. Under Kennedy, in the flap between the U.S. and Britain over the Skybolt missile, he asked Richard Neustadt, who was a political scientist and a presidency scholar, to study it and see where things had gone wrong. And I think with the Cuban, with the Bay of Pigs, you had there president recognizing that things had gone wrong, and he wanted to find out what happened and so that they could not repeat it. And I think that sends a signal when everybody knows you're doing those kinds of things.
It's on the job training. And that's why he was so prepared at the Cuban Missile Crisis. He could not retreat. At the same time, he wanted to leave some space for a dialogue. He was a man of peace, really. And I think both he and Khrushchev, Kennedy and Khrushchev, were heroes because they both had the statesmanship to step back from the brink. Each had a nuclear arsenal that could blow up the world, and they cared more about humanity.
Except they got to that position in the first place.
Well, because there were missiles in, but that didn't mean that. And once we found out and were aware of them, then that's when Kennedy began to realize it. And also, they showed them to the American people. We didn't see any weapons of mass destruction in the run-up to this war, but we saw the missiles in Cuba when they were preparing for the, mm-hmm. I mean, when it went down to this crisis,
yeah.
red alert.
What do you think has been the consequences for the news we get from news organizations of all of the economic problems that news organizations have had?
Starting there's a lessening of covering the White mm-hmm. House, closing down of bureaus all over the world at a time when we really need them. We should have more and more reporting from the Middle East and mm-hmm. all over, because the potentiality for danger to all mankind is out there, and if you don't have these bureaus, and they've all been shut down because of the economy. Mm-hmm. Even, I mean, television networks you would think would have much money, but they're not doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it also, the White House used to be a beat that correspondents, both in broadcasting, just in my short life experience, wanted to do it towards the end of their career. It was like considered a plum, mm-hmm. right, to cover the White House. It was a real, you know, you were really something if you cover the White House. Now reporters tend to want to come in very short, early in their careers, and want to stay a very brief amount of time. They don't stay a long time. It's unusual to find someone like you who's covered the White House a long time nowadays. And this administration...
To me, that's the fulcrum of news in Washington.
Yeah.
Everything comes to the White mm-hmm. House, mm-hmm. whether it's trivial or War and Peace. Mm-hmm. That's the breadth, the latitude mm-hmm. of this uh-huh. beat.
The other thing is that as this administration has been very crafty about not giving reporters information, at the same time they're trying to persuade the public that we're not essential, that we're not credible watchdogs, which they work hard to do. News organizations that are trying to justify on a short amount of small budgets, the White House beat, start saying, well, what are we getting for this manpower? Because this administration is making harder and harder to cover and come up with stories off the beat that mm-hmm. reporters can deliver to the shareholders as being worth, you know.
Since the shareholders have a dominant word now,
right.
and they've become corporations, news is lesser. It's entertainment,
yeah.
and that's where they're making the money. And that's
right.
a very sad thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the networks used to pride themselves on having these bureaus all over and so mm-hmm. forth. Now they don't. They mm-hmm. won't put the money
out. And being part yeah. of democratic engagement, it's mm-hmm. a civic responsibility.
And mm-hmm. part, there were a lot of news organizations that were family-owned enterprises.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
And so, that's right. So they were willing, they were not so worried about the bottom line.
Right.
But on the question of the view of the press, there is no question that the ultra-right in this country has tried to demonize the press. And the news organizations have not fought back enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the reasons is that we're sinners, too, and I mean that in the broadest sense. If you have Jason Blair or Stephen Glass, that's the New York Times and the New Republic. If you have Jack Kelly from USA Today, columnists who are plagiarizing and getting fired, you've got all kinds of controversies over confidential sourcing. We're playing into the hands of the critics, and I say we, meaning in general, the media, the major media, because we get caught doing things that you wouldn't do.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't say we, because there are thousands of reporters who have played
right.
that kind of a game. And I think that we still have high ethical standards, but everybody with a laptop thinks they're a press reporter.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reporters that I just named worked for major news organizations,
yeah.
and they were not either well-supervised or their colleagues who had concerns about them were not listened to.
They got fired immediately. I mean, this is mm-hmm. what happens in journalism. Your faults. Your report card's on the front page every day. There is no waiting around. I mean, you either have the job or you don't.
Do you think part of it is that we are making demands on transparency of news organizations that we didn't used to make? So we do find out more about how people do their work. And so there may have been people in the past that did things, but they just... we didn't find out about them because people didn't make the demands.
I'm sure
yeah.
that's true.
There was a lot of messing up. There's no question. New York Times and Washington Post. I mean, the whole question of the coverage of the war, which I keep bringing up, but I still think that Washington Post had 40 editorials leading up to mm-hmm. the war. They had to go to war and so forth. And they had these stories about all these weapons and so forth. They all should apologize to the American people.
Mm-hmm. But on at the same time, the Washington Post also had pieces by Walter Pincus.
Which they put on A20 right. And later apologized.
A17. Right.
And New York Times put a lot of phony stories on the front page, and they apologized much. Two editorials. Mea culpa.
Let's go to some questions, and we'll have questions in both places. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, to the extent that we have seen an unprecedented expansion of executive authority and sort of the way the president deals with secrecy and things like that, to what extent is that a function of him not having a Congress that is willing to check? I mean, for only 9 months, was there any part of the Congress that was held by the Democrats? And even then, after 9/11.
Yeah, because you were talking about that.
I think it's a super good question, and what I was trying to mention earlier was that when you have single-party control in Washington, you're giving up part of the checks and balances that the city tends to function with. One of the things that's frustrating is that, and Martha and I have talked about this, is that if you have a weak opposition party, and in this case it's the Democrats, you can't expect the fourth estate, the media, to function in the same way with the same powers that a very vigorous opposition party possibly could or divided government could. So what has happened, I think, is that it has only fed into the president's ability to, quote unquote, get away with the kinds of techniques and tactics that he has argued are essential in wartime, or essential to national security, or essential after 9/11 in an era in which we believe, as Americans supposedly, that terror cells are already in the United States operating, et cetera, et cetera. Or that we have a free media and that we don't want to educate the enemy. So I think your question is absolutely a great one. And to the extent that the voters get a chance to think about that in November, news organizations like mine are paying close attention to what's happening in public opinion polls, to the sense of what's good or bad about having total Republican dominance of every branch of government.
Because you find in Watergate, for example, that that the Democrats were controlling the Congress, and so they set up committees really in both houses, and with subpoena power, they were able to get the information that they wanted.
You know, what's interesting is the public seems to be more, at least in my assessment of some of the polling, more worried about Republicans' ethical abuses, like the Tom DeLay or Bob Ney, Congressman Ney, with lobbyists, much more up in arms out in the countryside than they seem to be about the president's assertion of control over information. There seems to be a kind of reservoir of support for the president's argument there. But what's undermining Republicans is the sort of party control that gives them carte blanche to do whatever they want to do with money in politics, with lobbying, with, fat cat earmarks for their friends, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And then just a quick question in response. Do you notice the only other period that I can think of in a long time, you've been covering Washington, where we had a single party government was, the Kennedy Johnson administration. So do you notice any sort of trends?
Right. The two parties.
And Clinton had it very briefly.
Very,
very briefly.
What trends there are when you have a single party controlling the Congress and the presidency? Are there similarities between Republicans and Democrats?
No, I think that the Democrats are much more freewheeling. Mm-hmm. I mean, I felt that the Republicans had more say. I don't think the Democrats have anything, but I think their fault, too. They've gone into sort of a coma when they should really be shouting. They've got a gold mine here of everything.
Well, when the Democrats controlled, during the Kennedy and Johnson period, it's very different than the Republicans today because you had splits within the Democratic Party. And so that made it a lot different than, say, the Republicans are much more cohesive. Like the House has been so cohesive here, whereas the House was not during that time period. Towson? Yep.
Helen mentioned earlier about how the role of the press is indispensable and that it's to inform the American people about the presidency and about the president, about really what's going on, the inner workings. I was just curious to know, how does the press corps itself feel that the American people view the press corps? How do they feel that the American people actually view you yourselves?
I think that the American people know that we're indispensable, but they still don't like us, and they feel we're prying and so forth. At the same time, I think they want to know what's going on. And in the end, they will know the contribution. More than 80 members of the media, reporters, cameramen, assistants, and so forth, have died now in this war. I mean, we put our lives on the line. I haven't, but certainly so many colleagues. And I think that information is the most important thing. It's golden. It's what really makes us an educated people. And without it, and people do stick their necks out to get it. So I think the American people eventually will realize that the very fact that they want to turn on the news programs and what's going on, everybody knows it's so vital now. Mm-hmm. So I don't worry about that, because in the end, I'll tell you what my experience was. When President Nixon came into power, he started an anti-media campaign, which was kicked off by Spiro Agnew, the vice president, in 1969 in Iowa, wasn't it? Des Moines?
Yeah.
Des Moines right. Speech.
Yeah.
Was a classic kickoff of go after the press. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I first got into this so-called business, it is a business, they say, people would see you with all the tags. They could send me COD anywhere in the world. And they would say, oh, you're in the press. You meet such interesting people. Isn't it wonderful? Well, after the Nixon campaign, they practically spit on you. I mean, you're in the press. Why don't you write the truth and so forth? But in the end, after Watergate, and when the president, first president in American history, was forced to resign, people would say to us, and I certainly was not a part of that, but they say, you saved the country. And that's the greatest thing that the reporters, mm-hmm. when they're constantly putting a spotlight on corruption and everything else. Mm-hmm. It's very, very important. Mm-hmm.
If I could just add to that really quickly, I think that a lot of reporters are very aware of where the general press corps stands in public estimation, and there's been a lot of very good studies done. Most recently, the Pew Center for Research in the Press did extensive work looking into public perceptions of the media in 2005. And one of the things that really interested me, where there were two really, one is that we're a lot like Congress. God, I hate Congress, but I love my congressman. So it's you pick that up in public appreciation of the media. Gosh, I hate the New York Times, but I love my paper, my reporter. And part of that has to do with the fact that the public knows that they get a lot more out of the news media, like what's the weather, the sports, whatever. It's a broad extent of information consumption that they know that they're using, so there's a split thinking. The other thing is that it has now become a partisan divide in terms of an appreciation of the media. Pew picked up this, what I see every day covering the White House, which is that there's this Republican, heavy, heavy Republican sense that the news media in general are liberal, biased, put that into their reporting, don't like Republicans, they're not credible. So there's a much more extensive sense of outrage about the news media among Republicans than among Democrats. And so in some way, that public appreciation about the media is just like it is about politicians. It's very partisan.
Mm-hmm. What would you say that the impact has been in the growth of partisanship in Washington, and as far as coverage is concerned?
I think it's been detrimental to the extent that it's so mean-spirited. Mm-hmm. I mean, true differences of opinion. I'm a liberal. I've shouted to the world. But I consider that when I was a wireless service reporter, I'm a columnist now, but when I was, I can assure you there was no slant, no bias. My editor wouldn't even allow a verb that seemed to connote some sort of slant. And I think reporters do a fair job. It's just that I really do think that the Republicans came in very mean-spirited. They had been in the wilderness for 40 years, and they were going to get revenge.
You know, writing for a nonpartisan weekly magazine, which is rare, right, both weeklies and being nonpartisan, one of the things that I am concerned about is that there seems to be an understanding or an appreciation that the way to battle what is perceived as bias or skewed reporting is to have your own biased and skewed reporting, so that if Republicans have been upset about the news media, their antidote is to have news outlets that are skewed in a direction that they're much more comfortable with, which I think is absolutely...
That becomes the truth.
It is the wrong way to go, and to the extent that this administration has tried to help that along, and when I say help that along, what I mean is to pay someone like Armstrong Williams $240,000 out of taxpayers' money to write favorable syndicated columns about the president's education policy, that's the president's idea of getting an edge. He later said that that wasn't good, that the education department shouldn't have done that. But you remember they paid for video news releases for the Health and Human Services Department to talk about Medicare prescription drugs. Those are all manipulations, and that's the wrong answer to the complaints
and
about.
And the Pentagon is planting positive stories in the Iraqi crisis.
Paying for Iraq, yeah.
But the CIA has done that in earlier administrations, hasn't it?
But it was not as heavily focused.
It's just, it's like now it comes out, and it's easier to get that information out to the surface. Yeah.
You actually just touched on this, and I would like to stay with this question a little longer, because there seems to have been sort of the 9/11 veil, which is finally now going away. To what degree is the press complacent and accomplice to the administration by actually not refuting this liberal biased accusation? And because when I observe newspapers, they sort of cater to the president by sort of sticking with his story, for example, with Iraq and so forth. So you're abdicating your own responsibility as an independent industry that's an actor to say, wait a minute, this is not what it is. We still serve a purpose, and we need to take control back for ourselves of the media. To what degree is there a discussion in news channels and news organizations, or do we just cater to the Fox phenomenon? Because Switzerland. And growing up in Europe, where you have five, six countries around with different newspapers, no news organization will get away with that, because the country next door would say, wait a minute, this isn't true, and change the perception.
Right. Well, let me just say, I myself am resistant to some extent about to what you're saying, because I think in this country, as I was saying, I just don't think people can expect the news media to be the opposition party. To whatever extent they're frustrated about reporting, I think to some extent it's a frustration because they're not finding their own bias there, or their own point of view has been established, and they're frustrated that they're not finding it in the reporting that they're reading. The thing I would agree with you about, though, is that immediately after 9/11, I think the news media were shocked just like anyone else, like any other country, like any other person, like any other city, about what the terrain was supposed to be. And that there was initially this national sense of patriotism and flag waving that the media were very, very aware of. Not at my magazine, I did not find that effect, but a lot of news organizations, I think that they felt that the management, the owners, the stockholders had a particular feeling about rallying around the country, and that it was unpatriotic to ask questions. I'm not saying the questions weren't asked, but I know Helen and I were in a briefing room with Ari Fleischer when he said, be careful what you say, because he challenged reporters because he knew the American public in general was immediately feeling that to ask questions was to feed into the arguments of the enemy or to serve the terrorists. And as you point out, that has gone away. But I would agree with you that it was there, and it was there temporarily, and I think pretty rapidly there was a pendulum swing back to what we're naturally much better at, which is not being cowering in the corner or being afraid or mm-hmm. being flag waving. The one thing that was also very effective is that the Pentagon decided to embed reporters. One of the things, and National Journal had a former editor who had gone on to be an editor at the Atlantic Monthly who was killed in the drive into Baghdad very early in the war. One of the things that really bothered me as a reporter, and I don't know what Helen would say about this, but that embedment experience had reporters on the air, mostly television that I noticed, saying we, as if they became part of the military. That was incredibly cunning and successful by the Pentagon's estimation in terms of telling a very circumscribed story about what those reporters could see or could photograph. But I really, really took offense at reporters saying we as if they had become part of the American cause against mm-hmm. Saddam or the Guard or whatever.
But you could also say that because they were there, they reported stories that they thought were important. For example, do you remember
that is not true. They reported on stories they could report on.
But let's look at the Washington Post story where a car was coming up to a gate, and they fired, and the troops fired at them, and killed the people in the car, and the military was giving out one story saying that there were like two or three people dead, and the Washington Post reporter said, "I saw 8 to 10 body bags."
But that was rare.
I just want to say the embedment experience was a very frustrating reporting experience because I know we had two reporters who were embedded, and one of them had covered the Vietnam War. He was the oldest, I think probably the most senior reporter who was over there, George Wilson. And he came back and he told all of us, and he was very careful in his reporting, what a frustrating experience that was because you could not get off. You couldn't get off and go interview the villagers. You couldn't get off and try to build a story that had multiple sides or dimensions to it. You were pretty much limited to what you could see, what you could witness, as opposed to what you could learn, what you could report. And he came back with a very cautious idea about that because his experience in Vietnam had been so different. You could jump out, you could patrol, you were free, you could go to different villages, you could do, and it was a completely different kind of experience. So he came back with a kind of sense of foreboding about what this was, not because he could report that it was going to go awry, but because he knew what he couldn't report. And he was very limited in his expectations of how this was going to go.
Reporters at the White House rolled over and played dead after 9/11. They all had to be patriots. They were afraid of being called unpatriotic, un-American. And as far as I'm concerned, they stayed in that comatose situation until the Cheney story and a few other things. They remained. Every day in the run-up to the war, we heard either Ari Fleischer or Scott McClellan say, Saddam Hussein, 9/11, Saddam Hussein, 9/11. I mean, is there any wonder that the soldiers thought they were in Iraq because of Saddam Hussein had caused 9/11, or the American people to this day? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was false. And then the false stories that were put out on Tillman, Jessica Lynch, and so forth. Mm-hmm. I mean, so mm-hmm. much, of course, mm-hmm. truth is the first casualty of war. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I didn't coin that, but mm-hmm. it's true.
Okay. Towson?
Well, that's not our job. I mean, yeah. I don't think I just don't see that as our job, is to offer words of support to the U.S. troops in Iraq. It isn't that you can't hope for the best for them, but we're not cheerleaders for the U.S. military in Iraq. I'm not sure, am I misunderstanding your question?
I'm on them out. Bring them home.
Well, one of the problems about reporting
feeling among some of the military. military.
One of the problems about reporting in Iraq is that it is so, the security, it is so unsafe that reporters are really limited in how they can travel and do reporting. That would suggest to me that there's a problem in Iraq in terms of how the war is going, because it is not secure. So they have a difficulty, and what they are reporting on, I think, is to them what they find most newsworthy oftentimes happens to be and should be probably the most extreme things they're seeing. It's not that you're not getting stories about the efforts to form a government in Iraq or what the elections were. I mean, you're getting those stories, but when people are dying in droves every day and civil war is the situation that even the U.S. Authorities are talking about, the ambassador, U.S. ambassador is talking about, I'm not sure how much reporters are supposed to be writing about, you know, the school that got opened, or, I mean, I think you have to be realistic about what reporters are doing there.
Mm-hmm. It's Russian roulette. I want to support the troops. I want to bring them home as fast as possible. War is killing and being killed. What are we doing there?
Anybody? Do you have someone, do you know someone who is there?
I served in Iraq.
And okay, you buried the lead. So, so where did you serve? What branch?
I was there in 2003 during the actual war, so I was moving around a lot.
So did you have time to look at news reporting and think it was very unbalanced or erroneous? So are you keeping in touch with your buddies or any of your colleagues who may still be over there?
Absolutely.
And do they think things are going well?
Did you see the poll today in the paper? They want to come home.
This is what reporters do. Sorry. do they think things are going well?
The Zogby poll says that 80% want 70%.
They think things are going smoothly.
What branch?
Okay, well, can you, well, I'm not covering the Iraq war, but the thing that's really difficult is I do think the access, you know, I mean, if there was good evidence that things were going well, reporters that I know, for news organizations that I know, would listen to that. I mean, I just don't want to leave you thinking that we have a preconceived notions, but I'm just saying that when you're faced with violence and you have the U.S. ambassador talking about civil war, I guess you get the feeling that things aren't going so great.
And the Secretary of State did as well.
Yeah.
Look at the casualties every day.
But I'm glad you're home.
More than 100 people almost every day.
Mm-hmm. A question here? Yeah.
Thank you. Looking at the fact that you've been a reporter for so long in the White House and throughout America and stuff, I know it sounds, I'm not putting this very well.
She's so experienced.
Experienced. Well versed.
On the job training.
Yes, exactly. Looking at the advent of the soundbite, the internet, lowered newspaper sales, have you noticed a difference in the rhetoric of actual news articles, and that perhaps reporters are trying to get the news right to the front so people will hear it? Or is it just simply we have a more informed, smaller percentage of the public?
Well, I think that mm-hmm. I don't see any difference in the style, but I do think that it's a tragedy that we have one newspaper towns now, and that the papers are really shrinking, and that people think that getting on the internet, they're getting everything. Nothing can replace a newspaper. It engulfs you. You read things you never intended to read, mm-hmm. and so forth. And it's to my regret that we don't have, we used to have 2 and 3 newspapers in every major city. And I haven't seen the difference in style per se, but I think that we have monopolies now.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? We do see the composition of front pages sometimes be different, where they'll put you know, a softer feature story on the front.
The Post is beginning to feature every day some horrible scene of violence from Iraq. Mm-hmm. And it's a new phenomenon because they really suppressed a lot, not the Post per se, but newspapers.
Uh-huh. One of my colleagues who covers the media for National Journal was talking to me today about the idea that because so many more people read newspapers electronically, the idea of a front page has changed because it's a rolling front page, and which is what you're pointing out, that as the news is happening, the presentation of it is getting reconfigured all the time. And so it's not that it's always set in stone and that's what everybody gets in the morning. So he was saying that that has really changed, and then I was telling him that I was in Wisconsin last week and was amazed to learn that the Wisconsin paper in the town that I was in electronically is providing their readers, as a way to lure them into the internet, a chance to vote on what should be on the front page the next day. So they give them a menu of options, I guess, late in the afternoon, and then supposedly you, as a participatory sport, can vote on what you think. And so then my colleague said, well, you know, the natural question to ask is, do they do this? Do they publish on the front page, you know, the lost dog story or whatever gets the votes? And I found out that it's even worse because they're telling their readers, vote and you can pick what should be on the front page. But then really what they're doing is they put a little item on the front page that says, here's what you voted on, and then you have to go to the inside. So they're actually encouraging you to do this and then cheating you out of the result, which I think is just two slaps in the face. So all the way around, I was saying in Wisconsin, this is bad. Do not keep doing this.
Uh-huh. But one of the things that's interesting with newspapers and with their internet links is that newspapers are trying to do both things. You know, the Washington Post is trying to give an excellent paper, but also put things throughout the day on the internet, and then having blogs within the Post,
or having chats where you're talking to reporters after the fact about how they did a story or what they think is happening on their beat, mm-hmm. so that they're trying to make the relationship between the paper and the community stronger, mm-hmm. Which is kind of an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, and you do get. In the spirit of transparency, you can ask questions and get a lot more about how the stories were put together, mm-hmm. and that becomes interesting. Towson?
My question's for Helen. With regard to the enormous amount of coverage of the issue of warrantless wiretapping, you talked about that earlier, the tapping of suspected terrorists and their accomplices, if you'll think back to the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, I'm sure you're aware that they both personally authorized wiretapping of Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders, and that also during the Carter administration, he authorized wiretapping of suspected Vietnam spies. And what I'm wondering is, when those stories came out, did you pursue them with the same fervor that you currently employ with the current administration? I'm wondering, do you view them as severely?
They were shockers, I can assure you of that, and they were certainly not across the board. Now everybody has a feeling they're being wiretapped. There's no holds barred. There is no reason the administration can't go to court and get a warrant. They have 72 hours, and these judges allow them a lot of leeway if they really had a crisis and a real terrorist going after them. This is baloney. They don't even want to take the trouble to get a court warrant.
You know, you're asking a really interesting question. One of my colleagues, who I mentioned earlier, George Wilson, who has a life of interesting reporting experience, was recalling to me that that the wiretapping of Martin Luther King was actually shared by Hoover and his colleagues with a few reporters who were supposedly trusted, and they were trying to encourage reporters to write negative stories about Martin Luther King. And so I was talking
to Sarah McClendon.
Yes.
J. Edgar Hoover told him.
Yes. And I asked him, trying to picture what that would be like now, reporters brought into a room by John Ashcroft, hey guys, get a listen to this, you know, what do you think of this or whatever. And I couldn't, first of all, I couldn't imagine it, but second of all, I was really interested to find out that the reporters did not write either about the tapes or the taping or use the information in any way against Martin Luther King. They accepted it as being offered to them sort of on an off-the-record basis, and that just could not happen. It just would not happen today.
Very isolated, and it was shocking.
Mm-hmm. I worked at one time at NBC, and the boss I had at NBC had been a bureau chief of a wire service. It was actually it was UPI, and in Chicago, and he had been offered the tapes on Martin Luther King, and he refused to listen to them.
But you know, if you think about the corollary over Valerie Plame, wiretapping is one thing, but clearly this administration was interested in asserting a set of facts to reporters to combat what they thought was the harm being done by Joe Wilson, and they tried to bring reporters into a sphere to exert a certain plan of attack. So I say it couldn't happen about wiretapping, but clearly it was something that reporters were struggling with over the Joe Wilson story. Mm-hmm. And the Valerie Plame, the facts of her relationship to Joe Wilson.
Well, reporters were being used, as they're always being used, mm-hmm. for a very insidious mm-hmm. motive.
With the large number of online news media, CNN, all that stuff, the one question I have, especially since I have to look through a lot of clips every morning for my job,
What do you do?
I just do the morning press summaries.
For?
For press secretary office for a senator.
Oh.
And so the main thing I came on thinking of is fact checking, because I'm like, I was told stories like 15, 20 years ago, you couldn't get a story in the newspaper without double or triple checking your facts. And now it seems like I go in the morning at 12:01, I got like 10 articles to read about this one subject. You know, I mean, at 12:01 a.m., you know, there's like 10 articles on this one subject. I'm sorry. Has fact checking becoming more and more of a concern? I mean, I'm a worry that it's not being done properly than it was like 15, 20 years ago?
Well, can I just ask you, what's your connection between the volume of material that's showing up at a certain time and your worry about its credibility?
Well, it's just that when I see the volume, I see a lot of contradictory, like one person says this, one newspaper says this, another newspaper says this.
And these are not stories about Greenspan.
No.
Just kidding.
I'm also an economist, so yeah. But
do they contradict one another?
You're reading a story about a similar set of facts,
right,
but it has different takes on what the facts are.
Yeah, like sometimes they say, like, this person said this on this issue, and then I'm looking at it and it says, oh, another person actually made the exact same quote. I'm like, and then I was talking to people in the press office about this, and I was talking to other teachers about this, especially I called back and called people from, like, working on journalism, and they said, they told me it's becoming more of a problem. I wasn't sure of that for sure, but...
You should talk to Helen about this, because she wrote for a news organization for years, in which wires are competing, and they have to get the facts instantly, and it has to be right, you know.
Well, what are you really saying?
Is it worse? Is it less credible now?
Yeah.
Is it sloppy reporting?
Is the need to get the story out first, is it overtaking...
You can make mistakes,
process.
But I don't think, you know, what the tragedy is, we only have the Associated Press, mm-hmm. literally, around the world. I mean, there's Reuters and so forth, but they certainly, there's one agency that's covering it, and I think they're pretty accurate. I think you can count on them. They mm-hmm. make mistakes, but not often.
But I think there's been more interest in trying to find out whether news organizations are making errors. And one of the things that you have now are the bloggers, many of whom will focus on a particular area. And so they will always be looking for discrepancies.
That's true.
Do you remember in the debates in 2004 when Cheney said that he had never met Edwards. And the bloggers had pictures before the debate was finished and had them up.
Or the National Guard record story in 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
Or Jeff Gannon.
Yeah, that took a little while.
That took a little while, yeah, that took a little while. But I guess I would say, you know, in the time that I've been a reporter, there's so many more news organizations and news outlets, news, and I'm putting quote marks around news. So if you are spending so much time in the morning looking at that broad swath, all covering the same thing, what are the odds? If I asked each one of you to summarize what we've been talking about here tonight, every one of you would have a different version. So to some extent, it may be younger, less experienced reporters who are rushing the clock. But I would also argue that if you're reading 12 versions of the same thing, it's like asking 12 people in New York, how did the mugging happen?
But the thesis is that there's an assumption now that you always get the news from television or radio first. So you may see different versions of something written, but I think basically you're sticking with the same
Sometimes path. We talk about how remarkably similar. I was in a television studio in which two print reporters, one for the New York Times and one the Post, they were both comparing leads that they had written about the same story, and they were they thought that they were channeling each other because their leads were so word by word choice similar, and that so their take was so mind-meld that they were a little horrified and thought that their editors might be a little spooked too.
Okay, we'll have...
I clear to see that as well. Thank you.
One last question from Towson.
Is it more difficult for reporters to obtain security while in Iraq than for U.S. conflict?
Can you get closer to a microphone? Is there a microphone you can get closer to?
Is it more difficult for reporters to obtain security while in Iraq than previous U.S. conflicts? And if so, to what degree would you say that the administration is involved?
Yes. You used an interesting choice of words, obtain security. If they could obtain security, they would definitely do it. You mean to be secure while they're doing reporting?
Or to get credentials? Or do you mean getting credentials?
Like, to be aware, are reporters normally around, security provided by the U.S.? Is that normal, or?
Yeah, it's the whole embedding program?
Yeah.
You mean embedding during the war or now trying to cover what's happening in Iraq?
Right now, trying to cover.
Oh, well. Yeah, they have a lot of trouble doing that. In fact, you know, as Helen and I were saying, you know, that the reporters and news organizations that we know of are investing millions of dollars and buying their own armored vehicles and hiring their own security forces so that their reporters can travel in a very limited amount of space.
Russian roulette.
In Iraq. Oftentimes just limited to what they call the green zone, the secure area that operates as the entity of the United States. And reporters who are freelance, who are trying to cover this war for news organizations that don't have millions of dollars and aren't giving them that security, are reporters who are getting killed or are getting kidnapped or are finding it really just... A complete investment of chance, fate, what could happen to you to try to cover war. And that is, as I was trying to say before from talking to my colleague George Wilson, who covered the Vietnam War, quite strikingly different because the enemy in Vietnam was as interested in trying to use the media or was in somewhat deferential to the safety of media.
And there was some respect for press coverage.
Right.
And press credentials.
And they were considered sort of hands-off. Even even the Kosovo War, as many casualties as you had there, it was a completely different feeling about being a target, just a target the minute you went out.
Mm-hmm. But the Christian Science Monitor.
Right. Girl. Jill Carroll is an example of that. She did not have the same kind of security. No. She did
and
have.
Her driver was killed.
Yeah.
No, and that the other. Protection is not there anymore. There's no such thing because there's such hostility everywhere. Yeah.
And the other day at the dome, the Golden Dome, there were three reporters killed. And I think they were from Al Arabiya, weren't they?
Right.
And
they were television crew and correspondent. Mm. But interestingly, I've heard discussions among news organizations that are trying to make a decision about what their employees' lives are worth, that their lives are not worth losing if the tide so quickly goes against them. I mean, if it's so clearly that you're at risk, they're trying to encourage their correspondents and staff to be realistic about that they want to cover the news, but they're not sending them to their deaths, knowingly sending them to certain death.
Mm-hmm. One last question from here.
Hi. I was just wondering, like, you were saying before how, like, most people turn to TV and radio before they turn to newspapers, and there's less and less newspapers now than there ever have been in American history, and I think it's really hard to get any news from television because they only have 30-second slots and there's no angle to the story. It's just whatever they can put in that time slot. And going further, and this is kind of where I'm trying to get at, like a station like Fox News that has been around for such a short amount of time, and all they seem to do is take whatever the administration's doing and spin it in a positive direction, and no one's like attacking them and saying, like, you're not showing the other side to a situation. So how do you guys feel about that? Like, because it seems like so many people in this country think that things are going well, but I think it's only because they're watching Fox News and they're not reading anything that's actually, like, you know, shows both sides to a situation. Like, I just think that, like, journalism's just gone, like, up in the air because of things like that where no one cares that they're reporting very one-sidedly and everyone's just accepting it. Like, I don't understand why.
I guess I would say that I'm going to take heart with, if this gentleman is saying he's got 12 versions of the story and you're afraid that you only have one or two versions of the story, that's somewhere in the middle. My argument is that you have lots of access to information, much more. With the touch of a keyboard, you can read any newspaper in the world. You know, go read the Swiss. You know, go read what's happening, you know, in the UK. Read, you know, go read the press. I mean, you can do this from your bedroom, your living room, your kitchen.
But like,
so my argument is you have to, some of the responsibility is yours. And you have to use judgment. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to be self-selecting about choosing only the politically oriented coverage that you like. But as Helen was saying, the beauty of a newspaper was to open it up and to be surprised, to learn about your world by encountering something you didn't know or couldn't have expected to be interested in.
But, like, the point I was trying to make is that an average American will not do that. They'll flip on the TV, and that's all they'll see. And, like, that's...
Not to put too fine a point on it, an average American of your age seems to be unwilling to do that. And that's a difficulty, a challenge for the news organizations that Helen and I have written for or work for, because they're so interested in selling you toothpaste and making you buy, you know, new cars. And they want to know where you're going for your information. There are 1,400 newspapers in the United States. Yes, that's much fewer than there were. But
they're all owned by, like, five people.
Well, but that's not to say that you don't have choices where to go to get your information. So my argument is always you have responsibility and try to read widely and try to surprise yourself. I mean, if you don't like a paper-based newspaper.
Or a network,
try to electronically access information. But the problem with electronics is that you're not going to find that story about global warming or a medical story that is going to illuminate your world in some way that you hadn't expected because you're being very self-selective. Mm-hmm. But you're right, it's a problem.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. Good questions.
Absolutely.